IndieCast is presented by Uproxx's Indie Mixtape.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to IndieCast. On this show, we talk about the biggest indie news of the week, we review albums, and we hash out trends. In this episode, we talk about the song of the summer. Local natives, and an update of the fantasy albums draft. My name is Stephen Hayden, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host. He also confused Haley Joel Osment with Joel Osteen. Ian Cohen. Ian, how are you?
I'm going to skip ahead to recommendation corner and say, if you want to listen to a rapper who never gets Joel Osteen confused with anyone else, listen to Beat King. This is a very deep cut for people who like Houston rap from the middle of the 2010s. But I just remember Beat King would always say he'd be watching TVs in his car, and one would be showing porno and the other would be showing Joel Osteen because he's from Texas. So yeah, Beat King. We're going to do a bonus recommendation corner.
That's beautiful. Well, ahead of the Beat King thing, we need to fill people in on those who are not keeping up with diss tracks this week. Kendrick Lamar emerged from wherever he's been
to record
a diss track about Drake. It's called Euphoria. Do we know why he's dissing Drake?
Oh, yeah.
Did something happen with Drake? What's the deal there?
All right. So I know people do indeed come to us to explain this Avengers-style beef of 2010 top-line rappers. So
they're getting all the news they get from this podcast. The sports news, politics news, film news,
one-stop shopping.
TV, yeah. Diss tracks, everything.
Yeah. So over the past, I want to even say maybe even month, there's just been this round of diss tracks going about with Drake and Future and J. Cole going at each other, and Rick Ross is involved, Metro Boomin is involved, Ja Morant is involved somehow. Apparently Joel Osteen and Haley Joel Osment are catching strays. So, I don't think our listeners will mind if I get kind of basketball playoffs with it, but it all just kind of looks to me like the first round of the playoffs where Joel Embiid and LeBron and Steph Curry and KD and possibly Giannis are going out in the first round. I mean, these are all rappers who are still probably the biggest rappers alive, but in a way kind of 2010-ish and washed. And it just feels, it's exciting in some regard because this is clearly the most I've ever cared about a Rick Ross and Drake and Future album in 10 years. But also, they're beefing about emotional maturity and fatherhood and cosmetic surgery. It just reminds me of when I come home sometimes and my wife tells me about what she saw in Vanderpump Rules that day. And it's kind of hard for me to keep all of it straight, but I kind of have an outline of it. So essentially, yeah, there's just the big three is, Future, Kendrick, and J. Cole. Oh no, it's Drake and Rick Ross. And I know that might not be a real granular explanation of it, but just know that these enormous rappers are beefing at each other and making 7-minute diss songs. The songs themselves are whatever. It's not going to be The Takeover or Ether, where these things kind of stick around as actual songs or hit them up. But I will just say that anytime someone asks me what I think about this, I just recommend them some RXK Nephew songs so they know what a real diss track in 2024 sounds like. I don't know if you're anything like me.
I mean, I think we're covering this because we have a vested interest in 36-year-old people arguing. I feel like that's part of our beat.
Yes.
So that it's pertinent in that regard. You made references to some of the most well-known diss tracks of all time, Takeover, Hit 'Em Up. And my thought on this song, Euphoria, is shouldn't a diss track be funny and fun to listen to? I feel like that should be inherent to this genre of song. I mean, look, everything Kendrick does, this song, it's a very technically impressive demonstration of lyricism. It's very dense, and he is very surgical in his takedown of Drake. I mean, this is the equivalent to a mean book review in book form, the rap equivalent of that. Very thorough. Although, as I alluded to in the intro, there is one big mistake in the diss track where Kendrick appears to make some references to the acting career of Haley Joel Osment, the star of The Sixth Sense. He was also in the Steven Spielberg film AI. I think he went on, wasn't he on Entourage? I think he, yes, as an adult, he was on Entourage.
Yeah, I think he carved out a role for himself, because he looks like he looks like the sort of dude who's like, oh, if you told me that was the basis of Death Cab for Cutie, I would believe you.
Yeah, he's like a burly guy with like long hair and a beard now, but he still has the Haley Joel Osment face. Yeah. So,
and he's also 36 years old. So
he's also 36 years old. So Kendrick appears to make references to Haley Joel Osment films, but he refers to him as Joel Osteen, the televangelist who is based, I think he's based in Houston.
Yeah.
Right? That's why the Houston rapper guy's referencing him.
Yes.
But you can see him all over the country. If you turn on your television at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning, there's a good chance you're going to see Osteen.
Yeah, that's all I got for you. You have exhausted my reservoir of Joel Osteen lore.
Yeah, he's a guy. I'm picturing him. He has like a perm.
Yeah,
going on
like a rictus grin, like clearly right. Like Botox the fuck out.
Right, it's like the real life Righteous Gemstones.
Exactly.
Essentially.
Yeah.
I
think that's actually what it's based on, that show.
Yeah, although I think there's even crazier examples of Osteen that are more regional
right.
that we don't know about. Like, Osteen is like the relatively...
mainstream.
Mainstream televangelist now. But anyway, Kendrick appears to confuse Osteen and Osment in his rap here. So that's like an unintentionally funny part of the song, but I don't know. Am I wrong here? I just feel like diss tracks, the best ones are funny. Like, they're cruel, but they're funny. I was thinking about, like, No Vaseline.
Yeah.
By Ice Cube, which is probably my favorite diss track of all time. That's really funny. And also, like, the music is great.
Yeah.
Kendrick's
not funny. That's, like, kind of his Achilles heel.
Right.
He can be very unintentionally funny. Like, I was listening to Pimp a Butterfly a few weeks back when there was that whole argument. It's like, oh, actually, this album is boring. That kind of made a little bit of waves. And it's not a boring album, but the song about where, like, God is a homeless person, like, that's kind of funny to me. Like, I think that's where Kendrick kind of... a lot of people were like, I thought Kendrick was above this sort of thing. And, you know, if you believe a rapper is above, like, a petty diss track, you know, that's kind of... that gives away the game right there. The reason I like the Drake diss tracks, even if, like, I don't always agree with them, is that he can be kind of funny. Like, he will say things that are just, like, really out of pocket. And, yeah, I don't think Kendrick has that in him. Future's too zooted out to do that. J. Cole is also too earnest. Him and Kendrick are kind of two sides of the same coin, so...
Right.
The best thing, though, about this, the best, if you want the funniest stuff, you got to go to Rick Ross's Instagram page. That shit's funny.
I was just thinking about Kendrick. He also did record a song with U2.
And like, I forgot about that.
That was on Damn.
That. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I completely forgot about that.
And bringing Bono on to a rap song in, like, I think that was 2017. It was on Damn.
Mm-hmm.
That's a funny idea. Although, again, not intentionally funny. Drake is someone who seems to have at least some level of self-awareness and awareness of his own ridiculousness that he will lean into it sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't, again, with him, I might be giving him too much credit, but I do feel like, because he's a very memeable person, obviously, he's been memed many times. So I think he's got some sense of that. But yeah, he's not like a witty guy, really. I mean, you're not going to him for clever lines. And also, he supposedly doesn't even write his own lines. I mean, that was like another thing that was floating around this week, reviving the accusations about Take Care, like how he didn't write anything on that record.
It's a great fucking record. But, I could give a shit who wrote it. I mean, you can believe it was written about him. So, that to me is like a non-starter as far as this stuff goes. I mean, we've been doing that for like, God, how fucking long? Like 10, 15 years? Like that, you got to come up with some new material.
Damn it. The basketball analogy, I think, is really good. I think you're right. I mean, there is a, it's like people care about the playoffs more when LeBron and Golden State are in it, but there is also that fatigue with them. It's like, okay,
let the 2020s happen, you know?
Right, exactly. It's 2024, you know, the 2010s, they're over. It was a mixed bag, even in the moment. Let's move on here. I mean, that's just true in all parts of culture. I mean, you look at the election. It's like, Jesus Christ, these guys, these guys again, that's like the predominant narrative at all corners of culture and politics right now. It's like, really? Again?
Yeah.
Let's move on here. We need like the equivalent of Anthony Edwards and SGA in politics. You know, that's the fresh blood we can get excited about.
I think that statement really did make good on our claim a few minutes ago that people will come to us for politics, sports, music. Like, that really, the unified theory of IndyCast, you just nailed it. We could retire on that line.
I like to imagine that there's at least one listener out there who consumes no other media except this show. So they're like, I don't need anything else. I'll just listen to the show. I'll get everything I need. All the important news right here. Speaking of important news, there is discourse happening about the song of the summer.
Yay.
It's back. Actually, you know, I can't complain about this too much because we are in May and summer is upon us. There have been years when the song of the summer conversation, which, by the way, if you're a regular listener of this show, you've heard me complain about this. It's an annual tradition. I feel like when this ever comes up, I always end up complaining about it. It is my least favorite story of the music criticism calendar, the debate over the song of the summer. I like songs of the summer in theory. I just like it to be organic. I feel like it's become a pageant. Well, it's not that it's become a pageant. It's long been a pageant of content writing that we have to speculate on this starting in February about what's going to be the song of the summer. It was this discourse got fresh life this week because there's a new song from someone named Sabrina Carpenter, who I know nothing about. I'll be up front. I think she's toured with Taylor Swift.
Sounds about right.
On the Eras tour. That's all I know about her. She has a song called Espresso. That, I don't know if you've heard this song. It's sort of like a throwback disco type song with terrible lyrics that are endearing. They're endearingly terrible. Like, I don't know what the connection is to coffee products, really.
It does rhyme with a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I don't think it's literally about espresso. Just like a nonsense word you throw into a disco jam, essentially. But anyway, people have been talking about this song. They're calling it a bop. Do people still say the word bop?
I don't know.
Has that word expired yet?
You're more up on the song of the summer discourse than I am, but I imagine maybe so. That's the case.
But people are talking about this song, and it's apparently in the pole position in the song of the summer sweepstakes. Have you listened to this song?
Yeah.
Did you shoehorn this in between new emo releases this week on the Ian Cohen music listening diet?
Yeah, I was thinking about not actively trying to seek it out just to see how long it would take me to absorb the, you know, de facto song of the summer in real time and real life. But, you know, for the purposes of the episode, I did listen to it. And my first thought about it is that it reminded me a little bit of the Barbie movie. One line that Greta Gerwig said that really stuck with me about that movie is that she was doing the thing and subverting the thing. And so,
right,
you know, Espresso sounded to me like, in some ways, like a quintessential, you know, quote unquote summer jam. But there's something uncanny about the lyrics, like you said. It's just like a lot of times, like a lot of random words thrown together that sound good and become kind of memeable in their own way. And it's like not the sort of thing you can micromanage, even if it is like a very prefab song. There's just something kind of uncanny and, dare I say, kind of magical about the way it all comes together. And I think there's something sort of kind of organic about this because, you know, you got like Dua Lipa coming out with her album, I think, this week, which, you know, like that's the album that's supposed to provide the song of the summer. I just like the fact that it seems kind of settled already. And I don't think that's happened, gosh, as at least as long as we've been doing this podcast. Like, people either, like, this is really that definitively song of the summer, or people are just as fucking exhausted as we are. It's like, all right, this sounds good. Let's pack it up. Let's call it a day, you know?
I just feel like you can't declare a song of the summer until you're at a swimming pool or the beach or wherever in July, and the song comes on in the wild, and you're like, oh, okay, this totally works for summer.
What was the song of last summer?
I think it was Right Down the Line by Jerry Rafferty. I think that was the song of the summer.
I swear to God, that was the song. I went to a wedding this weekend, and that was the song they, like, walked down the... Or no, I think that might have been the first dance. Oh, I'm not fucking making this up.
Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, this is not at all a bit from us. This is, like, real-time reaction. That was the exact song that they played.
I need to know this couple. Yeah. I need to hang out with them. I was just looking at the lyrics for Espresso. Move it up, down, left, right-o. Switch it up like Nintendo. Say you can't sleep, baby, I know. That's that me Espresso? Okay. And then, I can't relate to desperation. My give a fucks are on vacation.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Hate that. My give a fucks are on vacation. And I got this one boy and he won't stop calling. When they act this way, I know I got him. So, okay, so it's like she's being the temptress here in the song. I do like that line, switch it up like Nintendo. I did laugh when I heard that one. So I'm giving Sabrina Carpenter the edge over Kendrick Lamar.
Where's her Pulitzer, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, where's your Nintendo reference, Kendrick? Come on. But yeah, I don't know. Let's just let this thing play out organically. I think we need to be in the wild in the summer before we can declare a song of the summer. So it might be the song. It might be some song that hasn't come out yet. It might be some left field jam, you know? I don't know. We'll find out. Not that we really care that much. I don't want to, like, act like I care that much about this. Let's talk about... We're going to take a hard left here. We're going to talk about local natives. LA's own. They're from LA, right?
They're definitely from LA. They are like, quintessential. When I lived in LA from, like, 2010 to 2016, like, local natives were, like, that band. Inextricable from that period of time in my life.
So we were talking about this band this week over the DMs because there was a Stereo Gum post talking about how a founding member of the band, singer and multi-instrumentalist Kelsey Iyer, has left the band. And apparently they have multiple singers in Local Natives.
Mm-hmm.
But, is that right?
Yeah, but him and Taylor are, like, the main ones. Like, this is like this is like a really significant, like, the entire band, like, from the beginning, they've kind of presented themselves as, like, you know, guys who met in college at UCLA, and they had multiple singers, and this is a very significant loss for the band. Like, it changes the entire character of them.
So, again, for those who may not be totally well-versed in Local Natives, this is a band that formed in 2008. They put out their first record, Gorilla Manor, in 2012. And I remember, like, at the time, them being classified as, like, a Vampire Weekend knockoff. I think at least that's how they were dismissed, maybe among the haters.
Mm-hmm.
But they just are such a quintessential band. I don't know if we want to call them blog rock. If they are, they're, like, late stage blog rock. But they are a part of that window of time in the early 2010s when this kind of indie rock still existed, kind of like a leftover from the 2000s type of indie rock that was so popular. It was still hanging on in the early 2010s. And then, as we've often talked about on this show, around 2013, you have this shift to a much more sort of pop-oriented type of indie rock, you know, personified by, like, Haim, Lord, the 1975, that whole generation, they come in. And it's interesting with that generation of bands that kind of hold over indie rock from the 2000s, because they don't really get talked about so much after the early 2010s. But there's so many examples of these bands being way more popular than they get credit for in the media. And we've talked about this before on the show. I mean, they're a little bit before Local Natives, but like Cold War Kids.
Yeah.
Is a band that I'm always amazed by how popular they are still. They played here in Minneapolis a few months ago, and they played at First Avenue, sold out show, huge line outside. And look, I mean, First Avenue is not the biggest venue in the world, but there's lots of like indie darlings right now that would love to fill that room. And they get way more coverage than a band like Cold War Kids does. We've talked about Lord Huron on this show before. They're another band I associate with that moment. Like, they are more contemporary to Local Natives. I don't know. It's really interesting. Local Natives apparently put out two albums this year. Did you know this?
Yes, I did. I think they put out one last year and a companion one this year.
Okay. And right.
Yeah.
Time Will Wait for No One. Was that the one that came out last year?
Yeah, I believe so.
And then But I'll Wait for You came out this year. I got to say, like, I was never a huge Local Natives fan, but I put on Gorilla Manor this morning and I was shocked by how it transported me back to 2012. Like, this is a record I would have listened to casually back then, but you know, you get that feeling in your chest, like when you hear a record you haven't heard in a while and it reminds you of a moment really powerfully. It's like the magic trick of music that a song can do that. I was like, oh, my son is about to be born and I'm still living in Milwaukee. Like, I had that feeling in my chest just listening to that record. So it's like, wow, Gorilla Manor. It's been living in my heart apparently without me knowing it. What's your relationship with this band? Like, I mean, you're in Southern California. I imagine in the circles you run in, Local Natives are still rock stars.
Yeah, these are my dudes. I interviewed them multiple times in the kind of Gorilla Manor 2010 through Hummingbird 2013 era, and yeah, they were the shit back then. They still are very popular, but I love how this band come, like, this wedding I went to this weekend has been extremely powerful for source material.
The Jerry Rafferty wedding?
Yes. So do I need to ask permission to bring up a piece from Your Favorite Band Is Killing Me?
Not at all. All right. Please.
So there's a story, like, it's one of my favorite, the chapter of Jack White versus Dan Auerbach is one of my favorite right. things that Steve's ever written. It's sort of about the proxy of the difficulty of establishing male friendship. And there's a story I believe you tell where someone comes up to you at a wedding and just completely goes Punisher on you, trying to challenge all of your opinions, right?
Right, right, yeah.
The exact opposite happened to me at this wedding. There was this one guy who I knew, like, he and his wife went to the Foxing Hotel Year Show in San Diego. They're friends of the bride. And he talked to me about how much he loves Black Country New Road. It was very pleasant. And on the way back to the, they live in Las Vegas. They were driving, and him and his wife, like, ranked their favorite Local Native songs. And, you know, we kind of came up to an agreement that, you know, Gorilla Manor is very much a time and place album. Like you said, it is very 2010s Los Angeles, post Grizzly Bear, post, I would say more of a Grizzly Bear, Fleet Foxes sort of sound than say Vampire Weekend. Although that element is really there. It's more like if Vampire Weekend met at UCLA as opposed to Columbia. And Hummingbird is, in my view, maybe the best non-The National Aaron Dessner production. Very cool album.
Oh, he produced that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'd recommend that if you haven't checked it out. Very kind of more muted and personal. And, we just kind of came to that agreement that, like, it's from that era for sure. They kept going. They kept making good music. But they've settled into more of that invisibly popular, like you described, satellite radio territory of, you know, Lord Huron also came up around the same time as them in 2010. Yaysayer would have been included in there had they kept going, but, you know, most people don't really think about them much, like you said, like Cold War kids. They were a little before local natives, but I thought about them in relation to, sometimes on Twitter, I'll post a modern rock tracks Billboard chart from like the late 90s, like 96, 98. And people see that and remember, it's like, oh man, I remember, I love that song. You know, they're not necessarily like Pearl Jam level or Nirvana level, but stuff that's like still enjoyable, like Sub Superstar. And I think like, I guess that local natives might be that in the 2010s or 13s that we're going to look back on maybe in 10 more years and think like, oh, they had some hits. You know, it's not that you have, I think local natives maybe got an unfair shake from, you know, indie people because they were getting compared to say Fleet Foxes or Grizzly Bear. When in reality, if you compare them to the bands that they are more in the milieu of, like Group Love or Foster the People or Cold War Kids, you're like, man, okay, this band really did have some fucking jams. So in the same way that you can put Stone Temple Pilots up against, say, you know, Candlebox instead of Pearl Jam and Nirvana, you know. So yeah, local natives always have a spot for them. There is like a non-zero possibility that they listen to this podcast too. So
Well, Gorilla Manor, again, like I was like, wow. Yeah, I was digging it. I had not listened to local natives in a long time. I mean, I was just thinking about how, like, their trajectory. Because again, like as you've said, I mean, they've had a successful career. They can tour. They've put out like 7 albums. Did you say?
Yeah, something like that. Albums. Yeah,
and which is a great career if you can get that deep into a catalog. I mean, that's a big achievement. But do you think they have a different career if they had put out their first record in like 08 and not 2012? Because I was just thinking about how, like, you know, like the National, they have a big profile still. Mm. And we can argue about, like, how good are their most recent records. But it's undeniable that they have a contemporary relevance that, like, a lot of bands from their era don't have. Or even a band like Fleet Foxes or, you know, like MGMT put out a record earlier this year. Like, what's the difference between them and local natives? Like, does it just come down to the quality of the music, or is it a matter of timing? Because I feel like the timing thing makes a big difference, just because they didn't get the kind of runway in, like, the indie mainstream that these other bands did. It's like so many of the publications just took a hard left away from this generation of bands, and I feel like they maybe suffered as a result of that.
I mean, look, I wrote the best new music review for Gorilla Manor back in 2010. So, I mean, they had a little bit of runway, but that runway like disappeared very, very quickly. But
yeah, they didn't get like the 3 or 4 album runway, nah, you know, that these other bands did. Yeah. Like the National had, you know, Alligator, Boxer, High Violet, you know, and then there's the Taylor Swift stuff that happens later on. So they're a little bit different of a band, but, yeah, I don't know. I just feel like that those early 2010s bands, there was such a hard pivot away from what they were doing in the media. But again, maybe that doesn't matter. I mean, they've had a good career regardless.
Yeah, I mean, I had to fight real hard for Hummingbird to, you know, get... Like, people were ready to turn by then, but, like, they didn't cooperate because, like, Hummingbird's a better record, in my view, than Gorilla Manor. But, yeah, I mean, I think that if they started... I don't see them as a band. I mean, they started as a band in 2008, and I think they're very much a product of its time, sort of like the Cloud Nothings discussion we had last time where, you know, Dylan started out his band making music that was influenced by Times New Viking and Vivian Girls. So they were influenced like by, you know, bands that were immediately more, you know, well-renowned critically. And I think what local natives did, they always had this kind of more accessible, user-friendly presentation than Fleet Foxes. You know, Robin Pecknold can come off as like a bit of a curmudgeon sometimes. You know, Grizzly Bear likewise. But these guys, you know, they're personable. They're SoCal. They make really good pop songs. And, you know, look, I think that played out in their career. And I say this with, you know, all due respect, the sort of people who I meet at weddings who, you know, were really into reading blogs in college and kind of tailed off. This is maybe the sort of bands that they kind of take with them. You know, it's like, I remember what this band was like when I was on the cutting edge and I cared, and, you know, I'm going to stick with them. And look, you can't argue with results. And
yeah, it is fascinating. Like eras that get frozen in ember for a certain audience. And that era, I think, is totally frozen for people of a certain age. You know, like, that's where I stop reading Pitchfork.
Yeah.
And it's like indie rock doesn't exist after that. Like, this is indie rock from the moment forward. So even if you're buying Local Natives records in 2024, it's like, well, that's one of the five bands that exists. They got Lord Huron, you got Fleet Fox. I mean, you've got, you know, Local Natives and maybe a few others. I think that's a very common phenomenon. For people, I think that's how probably most people listen to music.
Yeah, and all those people were at the were wanting to go to the Cindy Lee show. At least my friends who were like that in San Diego.
That's beautiful. All right, well, let's do our fantasy draft update. This is a big day for me. I have three albums out today that are on my team. You've got Jessica Pratt here in the pitch. Which is a record I wrote about on Uproxx. You can go check that out. I actually wrote about the record and also wrote about something that I think we've talked about on the show, which is something I really appreciate about Jessica Pratt, is that she is this enigmatic, mysterious person who does not write so-called personal songs or, God forbid, deeply personal songs.
Radically personal songs.
Radically personal songs. I mean, all songs, of course, are personal, but you know what I mean. The phenomenon of writing an autobiographical song about your love life that people can read in a very obvious way, what you're talking about, that is something that has just become dominant in music, not just indie music, pop music, whatever. And it's really refreshing to listen to a record where you feel like, oh, this person's just creating kind of like a fictional world in their songs. And it's as powerful as anything else, but it's not just a confessional about your private life or score settling against someone that wronged you in the past. That record got an 8.8 from Pitchfork as of today. This is on Thursday that we're recording. No Metacritic score yet for that one. This was my number one pick, I believe.
Yeah, and I would have. It would have been mine, too.
So I'm expecting, like, a high 80 from Metacritic.
91 is, to me, like, a floor. Like, honestly, I thought this was going to... I thought Cindy Lee cracked open the 9 vault, but, yeah, it's been... It hit the 8.8 hard cap. But yeah, I don't expect anything less than a 90 for this, which is, you know, A, deserved, and B, why it would have been my number one pick.
I imagine Jeremy Larson, friend of the podcast, who wrote the review for Pitchfork, did a really good job. I just imagine him standing in the rain outside of GQ offices being 9.9. and they just like pull down the shade. They're like, no, we can't do that again. We're giving her the 8.8. So that no Metacritic score for that yet. Waiting on that one. Another album out today. It's on my team. Mdou Mokhtar, Funeral for Justice, which... I love that album title. Very metal sounding album title. And this record is kind of like Mdou Mokhtar's most metal sounding record. I mean, it's definitely in the vein of his other records, but it feels like the most overtly rock album that he's made so far. And it's a really good record. That has an 87 currently on Metacritic. So thank you, Mdou Mokhtar, coming through big time for me. And then the third record from Jazz Maestro. Can I call him a Jazz Maestro?
Yeah.
I think he is. Kamasi Washington, his record Fearless Movement, currently has an 81. A little disappointed by that. I was hoping for like a mid-80, and I'm going to need it. But as long as he stays in the 80s, I'll be fine. So right now, all of my records have come out. On my team. I just don't have the Metacritic score for Jessica Pratt. But otherwise, like, my team is done playing. So, to review, Mdou Mokhtar, 87. Kamasi Washington, 81. Also had Maggie Rogers, Don't Forget About Me, the overperformer on my team, 84. Great. And then we have the choke artist. Taylor Swift. Last week was 77, down to 76 right now. A disaster.
The gift that keeps on giving.
A disaster, Ian, for me. Horrible. So I currently have, my score is 328, and that is waiting on Jessica Pratt, who will hopefully kick me up to, what, around 418, hopefully, around there?
Yeah. I did a little math, and I anticipated a 91 for Jessica Pratt. So, for me, I got Vampire Weekend at 88, Chewbacca Hutchins at 84. Nia Archive's my kind of flop pick at 78. So, that if you know, Mdou Mokhtar and Kamasi Washington hold pretty steady at where they're currently at, and, you know, there aren't any other Taylor Swift pants coming out of the woodworks, this puts me at a spot where Yaya Bey and Beth Gibbons, lead singer of Portishead, would have to average like an 84, 85 for me to catch you. In other words, we got a ball game.
Yeah. I think it's going to be close.
Yeah.
It's going to be close. If Taylor Swift had delivered in the manner that she normally delivers, I would have run away with this, I think.
Yeah.
I'd be comfortably ahead if Taylor Swift could have given me like a mid 80 at least. But instead, she's pulling a LeBron in the 2011 NBA Finals against the Mavs. Or is a better analogy like LeBron against Boston? Mm. What was that? Was that what year was that? Like where he just gave up? I think that was 09.
Yeah, I think that's...
Do you remember that series?
Yeah, I do.
Like he just like gave up, essentially, in the middle, I think, game five. Big flop era for me with Taylor Swift. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Beth Gibbons, I think you should feel pretty good about that one. I would expect an 85 from her.
Yeah, I mean, it could go either way because I don't know how much like juice there is behind it. I know people will like it, but... yeah, I don't know how much hype is coming up. And I haven't seen shit about Yaya Bey. That could be a Nia Archive 2.0. So, I like that we got a ball game. You know, usually the past two have been kind of blowouts. But, and also these are also interesting albums to consider as well. So, I mean, I like the Jessica Pratt album.
I was going to ask about that because I wasn't sure if she was up your alley or not. I mean... because it is a singer-songwriter record, and they tend to be a little hit or miss on that.
Right.
But she's such a singular presence. It's a singer-songwriter record, but it's more of a Jessica Pratt record. You know, she's not just doing like what every other popular singer-songwriter is doing. I mean, it's a definite vibe of her own. You know, you're going to get something that sounds like it was recorded in 1966. You know, it's going to sound big, even though the songs are pretty quiet and stripped back, and you know it's only going to be about like 28 minutes long. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what she's giving you, and that's what she gives you again on this record.
Yeah, Jeremy, in his review, used the word hypnagogic. I've never had to say that word aloud until now.
What does that mean? I've seen
basically this word... it means like chill wave if you don't want to say chill wave.
Right, okay, because this has become one of those words that gets bandied about. And I'm like, what is there a simpler way to say this? I feel like this is like a word that someone made up at like the EMP conference or something.
I think it is, but like you either are working with that or hit or like hauntological. But it does get, I'm like, these are real words. These are real music critic words. Even for someone, people like ourselves who have been in this game for like 20 something years, we still will never say this shit aloud until we record a podcast on it. But like her album and Cindy Lee kind of both work in that same sort of hypnagogic, whatever realm. But like Cindy Lee is obviously a lot longer. It's a lot more immersive. And Jessica Pratt to me is more of kind of an escape hatch. It's 27 minutes long. I like what it's doing. I like how it's a little bit more fuller of a sound. There are some drums in there. I find it a bit remote emotionally, which is, you know, understandable. But that being said, that's like a asset, not a liability. Because, you know, whether we're talking about the big, you know, albums of like Taylor Swift or what have you, or just even something like, you know, Waxahachie or Phoebe Bridgers, nothing like stuff where it's not like tabloid, but it still, you know, draws you in. It's like about them, it's about their lives. There's a very central focus to it, and I think you nailed it, where this is not a singer songwriter album, this is not a folk album, this is a Jessica Pratt album. Those things come around like once every 5 years. So
and I wrote about this in my column, I just find it refreshing at this time where you have an artist who again is not leaning on a personal narrative. And look, I don't blame artists for this. I blame the media for this, quite frankly, because I think the media puts a premium on this and how they cover artists, and artists are just trying to play the game, so to speak, in terms of getting their music out there. But I get so many PR emails, like, where the gender identity of the artist is put in the subject line, or like the mental health status of the artist is put in the subject line. And like, look, those are valid things to write about, but I feel like those ideas get forwarded so much at the expense of the music. And I just find myself being really receptive to artists who are not writing autobiographically and are just creating a persona, really, that they can put out there. And like, when I think about Jessica Pratt, she's like a character in a movie to me. Like, she's not like a relatable person, you know? She could be a character in a movie from like 1951 or something. And I like that about her. And you could say the same thing about like Lana Del Rey.
Right.
That's a big part of who she is. I think Mitski has gone in that direction.
Perhaps much to her fan base. Chagrin, you know, like her,
well,
fans,
yeah, like her fan base was so crazy.
Yeah.
Right. But certainly her last record, I feel like she was really going into that direction, which I think is really, I love that record. So again, I just appreciate that about this album, along with just like, just being a beautiful record.
Mm-hmm. And I want to give a shout out to the Mdou Mokhtar album. Like, you're right, there's some riffing on there. It is metalist.
Not, yeah, he's shredding.
Yeah, he's shredding for real.
He's a shredder. And like everyone, I mean, look, yeah, if you are into shredding and you haven't listened to Mdou Mokhtar, I mean, that's just like shred heaven.
Yeah.
And this record, again, I feel like there was a lot of that talk when people wrote about his last record. And it just seems like he's leaned into that. It's like, okay, I'm going to be like Eddie Van Halen, or I'm going to be like, you know, Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top, except I'm coming out of Africa with these jams. Yeah, it's beautiful. Really fun record. Let's go to the mailbag here. We got some letters in here. Let's see if we get to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to clear out the mailbag here a little bit. Thank you all again for writing to us. It's always great to hear from our listeners. You can hit us up at indycastmailbag@gmail.com. Ian, you want to read the first letter?
Yeah, so this comes to us from Mary in North Carolina. I wish we knew what part of North Carolina. But
it's Marie, I believe.
Oh, Marie. Ah, gotcha. Marie. Sorry about that, Marie from North
Carolina. She's trying to, like, you know, maintain some anonymity here. So
very
know,
Jessica Pratt-esque.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right, so with an upcoming Amen Dunes, is it Amen or Amen Dunes? Another name I've never said aloud, but you know who we're talking about. With an upcoming Amen Dunes release approaching, I wanted to get a yay or nay from y'all on Amen Dunes. So we got the y'all, North Carolina. Yeah, Amen Dunes. We really want to talk about it. What about you?
Yeah, so the record that Marie is referring to is called Death Jokes, and that comes out next week. I imagine that we'll talk a bit about that record in our next episode. Yeah, I mean, I'm a big yay on Amen Dunes. I'm a fan, generally, of the catalog. I have to single out Freedom, the record that came out. I think that was 2018?
Yeah, that was 2018.
Freedom came out. One of the best indie rock records, I think, of like the last, what's, I guess, 6 years. Just a great sort of widescreen, anthemic, beautiful, classic-sounding indie rock record. Just guitar jams galore on that album. And it's interesting thinking about that record in the context of Amen Dunes' career, what came before it, and also having listened to Death Jokes. Freedom does feel like their Meriwether Post Pavilion. You know, like the record that flirts with the mainstream, kind of puts Amen Dunes in a more commercial lane, and the record that, like, the artist really has no interest in continuing on with. Just to give a little early preview, I guess, of the Death Jokes conversation, I would liken that record to Centipede Hurts a bit, if I'm going to continue the Animal Collective analogy here, just in terms of it being the, at least what seems like, a deliberately non-commercial follow-up to the big commercial record. Like, if you are hoping that Amen Dunes made another Freedom, I'll tell you right now, Death Jokes is not that. I think the record has a lot of merits on its own, But yeah, it's pretty clear that Damon McMahon, who's the person behind Amen Dunes, didn't have any interest in making a sequel to Freedom. So that's an interesting thing. But yeah, I don't know. Do you go deep into the catalog? Cause, like, I'm gonna guess that you're a yay here as well.
Yeah, with Amen big Dunes. Yay. I'm on the same page with you as far as Freedom goes. That was a record which kind of not, it didn't make a trend out of it, but it did bring David Gray's White Ladder into the discussion. There is an element of that album in it, in that sort of like very stadium friendly, but also like kind of homespun drum machine thing going on. Also spiritualized in terms of, you know, just kind of interrogating big, you know, big religious themes. It sounds like a lot of stuff I like, and yet there's nothing like it at all. It's got the Chris Cody production going on. Yeah, just inexhaustible replay value. But that being said, I like the album before it, Love, that came out in 2014. It's a little much more raw and folky. I know quite a few people who not only think Love is Amen Dunes' like true masterpiece, but also one of the best albums of 2010s, full stop. And
that's the one for the heads, yeah, for sure. That's their... If I can continue the analogy, that's Amen Dunes Feels, yes, or Strawberry Jam.
I would say it's more like their Feels, because like the stuff before Love, that's like kind of, I guess it was called Here Comes the Indian and renamed Ark. That stuff's like way more noisy and like Sacred Bones. But yeah, the new album, look, this is like real inside baseball shit, but I only have the stream, which really limits my enjoyment of albums. It just makes the process of listening to advances really annoying. And I don't know why they still go out. It's not 2006. I'm not going to leak your Amen Dunes album, but I do think I do envision that one as something that I'm going to need to take more time to absorb once it finally comes on streaming. I don't think it's going to, you know, amplify the Amen Dunes fan base, or, you know, make them play bigger festival slots. But nonetheless, it does sound like they were trying to do something quite different. You know, even though like they went from Sacred Bones to Sub Pop, took 5 years to make the record. I think Amen Dunes is really doing their own thing. So like Jessica, yeah, Pratt, it's not a folk album. It's not a singer-songwriter album. It's an Amen Dunes album.
And I just want to echo what you were saying about sending the stream only for a promo. Publicist, come on. And maybe it's not publicist, it's probably the record label insisting on it, but that's terrible.
Yeah.
It's a terrible way to listen to a record. Streams are wonky. Sometimes there's like a limited number of streams that you get, so like you run out of streams, yeah, and then you can't stream it anymore. Just send the download. At least give a download option. I mean, I often will ask for a download, and if you ask, they will give it to you in a lot of cases. But yeah, the stream only, you're just making it harder for the person writing about it to appreciate the record. So I just think that's a self-defeating thing. Yeah, no one's downloading, no one's pirating this stuff anymore. I don't know. Let's get over the streaming only thing for promos. We got to move beyond that. I'll read our next letter. This comes from Gunner.
Yeah.
And Gunner didn't say where he is, but I'm going to guess Wisconsin he's in, because he went to UW-Madison. But I don't know, maybe he doesn't live there anymore. Anyway, Gunner, thank you for this email. Steven and Ian, I just wanted to follow up on the Lake Mendota Howdy Record Patio Tour banter from this week's episode, actually last week's episode. By the way, if you're going to like bring up Lake Mendota in an email, I'm probably going to read it. So well done, Gunner. I graduated from UW-Madison in 2022 and helped book program the outdoor stage on the lake there. We totally had Howdy lined up to play there in the summer of 2022, and it fell through about a month or so before the show was supposed to happen. Just some relevant lore I thought you'd appreciate. I'm still in contact with my former boss slash program director that oversees the bookings, and sent them the episode in jest to see if they can give it another go. I'll buy you both a pitcher on the terrace if it happens. Best, Gunner. So Gunner probably still lives there if he's offering pitchers.
Yeah, seriously.
In Madison. Thank you for the email. That is a great stage there at UW-Madison. I saw Bill Callahan play that stage. I think it was 2011 on July 3rd, you know, the day before the 4th of July, obviously. There were fireworks going off behind him. Like, he was playing at night. Like, he went on, I don't know, 9:30, 10 o'clock. And he was playing all the songs from Apocalypse, which was the record out at the time. I think he played Writing for the Feeling as the first song, or it was at the beginning. Just breathtaking. One of my favorite shows of all time. So, program director for the Lake Mendota Terrace, if you're listening to this episode, bring Howdy. And, I don't know. Ian, do you drink beer? I don't think you do.
I don't, but nonetheless, I'd appreciate it all the same. Although I would worry about how they might be able to charge more for the booking fee in 2024 than they could in 2023. But
that's true, because he's getting the podcast leverage now. The public will be demanding Howdy play Lake Mendota.
Yeah.
And they're going to up their fee. Maybe he can buy you like a pitcher of like protein shakes. Are you a protein shake guy?
I'm not a protein shake guy. Okay. Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of good ice cream up in Madison. Word around town is that it's like a dairy-centric part of the country. I don't know if that's true.
Oh, but yeah. America's Dairyland, man. America's Dairyland.
But I did get sent, I love that we're getting Howdy lore. Someone on Twitter sent me a picture of the acoustic release show that Howdy did in Austin. Where there was someone in front of the stage wearing a Japan Droids t-shirt. And it's like, hell yeah, wow, man. The brand is strong.
Love it. Love it. And you reviewed Howdy.
I did.
For Pitchfork. I think we talked about that last week, but it was published. Got an 8.3, a Best New Music. We were talking about this before recording. Feels like there's been a lot of Best New Musics lately from Pitchfork. Maybe we're just in a bumper crop of B&Ms at the moment. But because you get Pratt's getting one, you got one for Howdy. Mm-hmm. There's that Swedish rapper.
Wait, I actually like that one a lot.
That name is escaping me. So a lot of like just the Best New Musics, man. They're eating right now, man. They're eating galore. It's a buffet of Best New Musics.
I'm with it. You know, Mdou Mokhtar might get one. Look, I think that they're all pretty. Who knows if Kamasi might get there? It's a good time. Let's celebrate. But you know, I'm also I do want them to open up the nines, man. That 8-8 is a coward's nine.
Well, you know who isn't getting Best New Music? Taylor Swift. I'll tell you that much. 76, man. 76.
I'll tell you what. St. Vincent's got an 89 right now. That's like Randy Moss, you know? Like how.
Oh, wow.
It's like how Randy Moss just decided to stick it to everyone who passed on him for whatever reason. That's what St. You know, we did the Mac Jones Taylor Swift comparison. I think we're going to put St. Vincent Randy Moss or Jimmy Butler.
You know, St. Vincent to me, she's the female Beck.
I think she'd take
that. She's the artist. Yeah, look, you could take that as a put down or as a compliment. And I won't tip my hand as to which side I'm going on with this. But yeah, I just feel like, you know, Beck early in his career looked at as an innovative artist, someone on the cutting edge, and then eventually became just the epitome of like an establishment critical favorite.
Grammy core.
Who doesn't someone who maybe doesn't have like a ton of like cool street cred anymore, but you know, like, okay, they're going to get a good review from certain publications, going to rack up some Grammy nominations, maybe even some Grammy wins. Female Beck, that's St. Vincent to me. I'm calling that one right now. All right, we've now reached the part of our episode that we call Recommendation Corner, where Ian and I talk about something that we're into this week. Ian, why don't you go first?
Yeah, so a couple days ago, I love when I come across like an emo album that's really making the rounds on Rate Your Music, or you know, which is like, you know, depths of the internet, but also in a weird way, the closest thing we can get to like 2003 style Pitchfork, where a band can come out of nowhere and like accumulate a fan base. I'm not saying that this is the case with this one, but it is a pleasant little record that came out a couple weeks ago from a Swedish band called Rain Recordings. The album is called Turns in Idle. I know Rain Recordings might be a little confusing. I thought that was the record label, but the name of the project is Rain Recordings. And I wouldn't call them emo exactly. They have a definite lo-fi Elephant Six 2006 style indie rock with Glockenspiel's energy to them. But that stuff's been mostly absorbed into emo anyway, so might as well call it that. it'll definitely bring you back to, you know, Ryan Catbird posting on MP3 blogs in 2005 or 2006. And it kind of rocks a little more than that stuff too. So I guess that's where they get emo from. So, this is kind of consolidating that Los Campesinos, influence on emo alongside like the Swedish bands that I mentioned on this, podcast before, like I Love Your Lifestyle. Cool little record. I think this one might have some legs if the right people stumble upon it.
So in my recommendation corner, I feel like I need to do a follow-up to some previous jokes that were made on this podcast. I don't know how long ago this was. Two or three episodes ago, I was making some jokes about band names of British post-punk bands. And one of the band names I made fun of was English Teacher. And I feel the need to come back and say that I've actually been listening to the debut album from English Teacher. It's called This Could Be Texas. And I've actually been really enjoying it. So I have to call myself out for making fun of this band's band name, because they're actually a good band. And I don't know if you've listened to this band yet, Ian, but, you know, they are definitely on the artier side of, like, the British post-punk spectrum. You know, they don't have that, like, guttural, like, Idols thing in their music. It is definitely more of, like, a prog rock type experience. In a way, I'm tempted to compare them to Bright Country New Road, except, and I say this with all due respect, they're a lot less annoying than Bright Country New Road, you know, in the good and you know, maybe bad senses. Like, they're a straighter version of that kind of proggy, theatrical type of British post-punk. But I don't know. I think this is a cool band. It's a cool record. There's a lot of ideas on this album. It feels like the kind of album where if this band makes it to their sophomore release, like, that could be the record where it really pays off. So I got to say, I made fun of the name, but English Teacher, good band. This Could Be Texas. I recommend checking it out.
Yeah, this is definitely one of those Shaq, I owe you an apology. I wasn't really familiar with your game things. Yeah, exactly. I gave it a little bit of listen, and it's like, yeah, I could see myself getting into this. It is an album I do want to spend more time with, because it does sort of remind me of Black Country New Road. It's so wild how already that band is so massively influential and also like a reference point to talk about other bands. And yeah, like, I thought the first Black Country New Road record was one of the most annoying fucking things I ever heard, and I love the second one, obviously. And so yeah, I think that this, and also, man, that's a record that's killing it on Metacritic. So I'm interested in checking it out. You know, I wish maybe there was like a cooler name, but look, I love bands called Japan Droids and Deftones. I can't really hold it against bands for having names that I'm sort of a little embarrassed to say aloud. Yeah, I definitely want to hear more from this.
Yeah, it was just like dry cleaning. I clowned dry cleaning before I heard that band, and I was like, oh, I actually like this band, even though the name... I don't like the trend of naming yourself after some mundane thing, which has been endemic to British post-punk for a while now. But
they just talk about the absurdity of modern life. Of course, they're going to call themselves, you know, Hole Puncher or things. That's actually more of a metal name, but you know what I mean.
Right. Well, at any rate, good record, good band. Thank you all for listening to this episode of IndieCast. We'll be back with more news and reviews and hashing out trends next week.
And if you're looking for more music recommendations, sign up for the Indie Mixtape newsletter. You can go to uprocks.com/indie, and I recommend 5 albums per week, and we'll send it directly to your email box.